Not many, he figured, had the dubious honor of seeing their last 5 years of effort burn. He got to see, in real time, friends and colleagues die. He watched as the secondary assembly line in Plant 52 exploded. If he stopped to think about it, he could probably say exactly who was on duty, who exactly had died. LaForge fumbled his way to the nearest chair and sat down.
All of it? Someone said.
The whole shipyard? He couldn't quite take it in. LaForge had been there himself 20 hours ago. He looked around. He could see the same emotion on the faces of the others there. How close they had been to all this. How lucky they were not to be among the dead. The logical engineer part of his brain provided the term. Survivor guilt. He'd be dealing with this for years to come. The news broadcast went on relentlessly. LaForge tried to piece together the situation. An attack on the shipyards. But whom by? How? Why? The synths, someone on the cast said. It started going around the room. The synths. The fucking synths. Those fucking things. Dimly, he perceived the extent of the anger, which soon would be raging like wildfire. Suddenly, the enormity of what was happening hit him.
Holy shit, he murmured.
Someone unobtrusively pushed a cup of water into his hands. He took a sip. He felt cold, clammy. Shock, murmured a calmer part of his mind. Because it wasn't only the construction yards, was it? It wasn't only the ships. It was everything. It was everyone. Everyone he had worked with over the past few years. Everyone who had grumbled and groused and complained and eventually had decided that, yes, all right, they'd throw themselves behind this insanely complex project. They had come around and seen the impact that they were having, the material good that they were doing, and had turned slowly but steadily into cheerleaders, defending their work to all comers, providing information at the drop of a hat for people like Olivia Quest and her committee. Every last damn one of them was dead, from the newest junior tech to all the division heads. Estella McKenzie, that tough, no-nonsense, dedicated woman who had been his first and stoutest supporter, the first person to knock on his door with a solution and not a problem, who had been behind their best breakthrough. She was dead.
The synths, he thought. What happened? Did we miss something? Did we make a mistake?
The cruelty of this was almost too much to contemplate. Estella McKenzie had not deserved this.
Maddox, he thought wildly. You haven't had your eye on the ball for a while now. What the hell has been going on down there in your damn lab?
Then the Martian stratosphere ignited.
No, no, no,
somebody said. People began to cry openly. Someone started to pray. LaForge detached himself entirely from any emotional reaction and shifted gear into a cool and purely intellectual response.
That's going to burn for years.
Verity. The Verity hung silently in orbit over Vashti. Picard raised his head from his hands when Raffi entered his ready room.
I read a message from Geordi LaForge, he said, but I'm not sure when he sent it.
I've raised him. He's on a shuttle back to Earth, said Raffi. JL, are you okay?
Picard briefly put his hand back to his brow, covering his face. He heard Raffi shift uneasily in her chair.
JL?
I'm fine. I'm very relieved to hear about Geordi, that's all.
The other news isn't so good.
He didn't move his hand. Tell me.
Everyone at the production facility is dead. They're trying to evacuate other parts of Mars. The stratosphere's on fire.
He listened as she steadied her voice and tried to report properly to her superior officer, tried to hold herself together.
Mon Dieu,
he thought. We are all going to need to find a deep well of courage.
He thought fleetingly of those Saxon warriors facing imminent annihilation, somewhere finding it within themselves to lift their spears and their shields for one last fruitless defense. He thought he knew now how that must have felt.
The ships, Jael, Rafi said. All the ships. They're gone.
Thought must be the harder, he murmured. Heart be the keener. Mind must be the greater, while our strength lessens.
What?
He looked up at her. Her cheeks were wet with tears.
Simply gathering my strength for the battle ahead.
The battle.
She understood. Of course, Rafi understood.
What's this going to mean for the mission, Jael? It's all the ships.
This will not stop us. It cannot. But we need solutions.
Ships, she said. We need ships.
Then let us look at what we have, and let us look at what can be found.
The comm chimed. They both started at the noise, as if caught in some indiscretion, and glanced at each other.
Admiral, Starfleet Command.
Jean-Luc, said Bordson. I want you back on Earth immediately.
Victor, I...
That's not a request, Admiral.
Paris, Earth. Maddox contacted Agnes Girati and they arranged to meet immediately, but not at work, not at their cafe, not even on the campus. Not a place where they might be seen or known. He wasn't sure why he thought they needed privacy and secrecy. They hadn't done anything wrong, after all, had they? No, they hadn't done anything wrong. After some negotiation, they agreed on Paris, one of the cafes beneath the trees in the Jardin des Tuileries. It wasn't hard to find her. She was one of the few people there. What kind of person went out socializing on a day like this? This was the kind of day where you stayed at home with your loved ones, holding them to you. The kind of day that in years to come you would suddenly remember, and a cold chill would envelop you, and you would turn to the person with you and say, "Where were you when you heard about Mars?" She was wearing a headscarf and black sunglasses, Audrey Hepburn style. Hot chocolate and croissant. Geez, he thought. What is up with her? How could she have any appetite? There was a book on the table beside her, the cover showing. Frankenstein. Was that supposed to be funny? He nearly grabbed the damn thing and tore it to shreds. He sat down opposite her. She took off her glasses. She looked haggard. Her eyes were red from weeping.
"Oh, Bruce," she whispered. "What have we done?"
"Nothing," he said. "We've done nothing."
"Are you sure? Can you know for sure?"
"Aggie, shut up for a minute. Let me think." A waiter came to take his order. "No, no, nothing," he said.
"You have to get something," said the waiter. "These seats are very popular. If you don't want them, someone else would like them."
Maddox looked around the empty garden.
"There's nobody here."
"You are, sir."
"Who the hell is out drinking coffee today?"
"I have something," said Agnes, pointing at her cup and untouched croissant. "Isn't that okay?"
"I'm sorry, mademoiselle, but the gentleman needs to order as well."
"Damn, man!"
Maddox exploded.
"Don't you know what's going on?"
"I know what's going on," said the waiter in a quiet voice. "Even less reason to be rude. And you still need to order."
"All right, I'll fucking order. I'll have a fucking Americano."
There was a pause.
"With hot milk?"
"Yes."
"That's not an Americano, sir. That's a cafe au lait. Unless you want the milk steamed, then that's a latte."
"Just get me a fucking coffee."
"I'm just trying to get your order right."
"For fuck's sake, I didn't want anything anyway."
"Bruce, please."
Maddox stopped. To his shame, he realized that the waiter was crying.
"I'm sorry. Black coffee is fine. I'm sorry."
"Yeah, well,
fuck you,"
said the waiter. He went off to get the order. They sat in silence, burning with embarrassment. Jurati started to tear the croissant between her fingers. The coffee arrived, black, with a little jug of hot milk. Maddox turned his face away. Even looking at it made him feel nauseous. The waiter finally left them in peace.
Bruce, Agnes said, did we do this?
Maddox calmed himself. He leaned in to speak in a low voice. He felt exposed out here, naked, unprotected in some way, as if there were a target painted on his back, as if someone were coming for him. Maybe they should have met at the lab, but the truth was, he hadn't been able to face going there yet. He hadn't even begun to think what he could say to the team.
What have I done? It can't be the synths, he said firmly. It's not in their programming. But you weren't only working on the A500s, were you?
She whispered.
Were you?
He didn't answer. He started to pour the milk into the coffee, swirls and spirals spinning around like fractals. The nausea hit him once again.
Were you, Bruce? Damn it, you know I wasn't. What happened, Bruce? What did we do?
He put his head in his hands. If he could, he would have put his head down on this cafe table here in the middle of the most beautiful city on earth, the city of light, the city of enlightenment, and wept like a child. He knew, whatever the truth of what had happened on Mars, that he was finished. His work was finished. His career finished. He had overreached. He had tried to do too much, to work on what was wanted by others, and at the same time, to do the work that was necessary for himself, the work he had to do to keep himself alive. He had been proud and vain and too sure of himself, and now Nemesis was hammering at the door. A couple sat down at the next table.
Bruce, she whispered again, is this our fault?
He ran his hand across his face. He was sweating. Was he catching a cold, or was this shock? The truth was that even though he could close his eyes and picture every last piece of circuitry inside every one of those damn toys, and even though he couldn't see anywhere, anywhere, that could have led to this, it had still happened, hadn't it? And he could not, hand upon his heart, with the scrupulous truth required by science, say that he had not made a mistake. Agnes was looking at him, lips parted, eyes trusting. He said,
I don't know.
Her face went slack.
No,
she said. He could see panic setting in.
Oh no, oh no, oh no, what have we done?
Aggie, stop it.
The couple next to them were staring at them.
Oh, God! Oh, Jesus Christ!
Aggie, he hissed. Shut the fuck up!
She pulled back as if he had slapped her. But he hadn't slapped her. He hadn't done that.
Okay, she said, subdued. I see. Okay.
I'm sorry. Please. Please, Aggie, I'm upset.
Okay, yes, I get that. Of course. I'm sorry, it's okay. I'm okay now.
She put her palms down flat on the table and took deep, steadying breaths.
Yes, okay. Calming down now.
She gave him a weak smile.
What do we do now?
I don't know. There'll be an inquiry.
Okay.
He looked at her carefully. She hadn't grasped yet what was going to happen, had she? She thought they had a chance. But they didn't. The people who were in charge, who had been behind the whole thing, they were going to turn everything off. They couldn't be associated with a disaster as huge as this. The robotics program at the Daystrom Institute was dead and buried. They might as well not bother going back to campus. No, he thought, seeing her smile at him. She hadn't seen that yet. But she would, very soon. His handheld chimed softly. He pulled it out of his pocket and looked at the incoming message. He was nearly sick again.
Who is it?
She said.
Geordi LaForge, he said.
He's on his way to the Daystrom Institute. He wants to see me. Shit!
He jumped up out of his seat. The jug of milk went flying, spilling its contents all over her book. She picked the book up.
Oh,
she said. She was crying openly now.
I loved this book. I loved this cover.
I'm sorry, he said. Aggie, I'm sorry.
He looked down at her for a moment, and then he ran away. He left her there, sitting, crying over her ruined book, and he dashed back to the public transporter and fled all the way to Okinawa. Daystrom Institute, Okinawa, Earth. Commander Geordi LaForge transported direct from the spaceport to the Daystrom Institute transporter pad. The director of the Institute, Sisra Coas, was there to meet him.
Commander LaForge, I am so sorry. I can't even begin to imagine.
He knew that he would have versions of this conversation dozens upon dozens of times over the next few weeks, months. Hell, it was going to be years, wasn't it? Because he was still alive when everyone else on Mars was dead. And he knew he was going to need a strategy to cut people off straight away, because he couldn't go through the rest of his life having versions of this conversation. He couldn't go through life being known as the one who got away. He wouldn't. Thank you, Sisra. He glanced around. This wasn't quite the welcoming committee he'd been expecting. Is Bruce Maddox here?
I've been trying to raise him.
Coas looked embarrassed, as she might, given the absence of her most prominent member of staff, who was the man of the moment.
It's most odd.
She laughed nervously. You know Bruce, like herding cats.
Gone to ground, hey?
LaForge tried to clamp that down. He had no evidence, none whatsoever, that Bruce Maddox was in any way responsible for this catastrophe. LaForge knew that grief did strange things to you, and one of the things it did was make you thrash around trying to pin the blame on someone. And sometimes there simply wasn't anyone to blame. There was only sheer, damn bad luck. He had to keep that in mind. Besides, that wasn't why he was here. He was here to start asking the right kinds of questions that would get answers. But for all his training, for all it was in his nature as a decent human being not to prejudge anyone, LaForge was finding it hard not to damn Bruce Maddox. He could at least have had the common decency to be here. Well, whenever he's ready, how about we go over to the production facility? LaForge didn't say the word synth. Everyone else was doing the same right now. Had the word acquired a cursed aura, as if simply saying it could draw disaster to you? LaForge was certainly not superstitious, not in any way, but the word still stuck in his throat.
Give yourself time, he told himself firmly. You're going to need time.
Coas led him over to the monorail that ran out to the far side of the campus, the brand new facility where the synths had been created. She tried a few conversational gambits and then thought better of it, leaving him to sit in silence. The whole campus was deserted. Whether this was out of fear or out of respect, LaForge could not guess. Speaking for himself, he never wanted to go near one of the damn things ever again. He sympathized with anyone who was keeping away from the place where they'd been made. At the production facility itself, however, he saw many people, none of them working, bunched together in twos and threes, watching the casts, whispering, some of them crying, some consoling. Everyone distressed. He walked through, thinking about the time he had been here with Mackenzie, their delight and excitement. The incredible feeling that they'd cracked the problem, that they had at last found the key to unlock the mission, to build all the ships that were needed to save a people. And now he was here, and Estella Mackenzie wasn't. And what he couldn't stand most of all was that she'd offered to stay here, keep an eye on things, because you knew Bruce Maddox. The man needed someone standing behind him with a poker. And LaForge had said, "Come back to Mars, Estella." Because she was his pal, and his fiercest supporter, and he wanted her around. If only he had let her stay. Maybe she would have seen something. Maybe she would have stopped whatever had gone wrong. And even if she hadn't, she wouldn't have been on Mars when those damned things had gone on the rampage. Estella, he thought, one day I might forgive myself. They came at last to Maddox's office. Sitting behind his desk, alone but watching the casts like the rest of them, was the man himself. Coas brought LaForge to the door. Maddox rose from his seat. She looked at the two men and said, I'll leave you to it. Bruce, said LaForge, what the hell happened? Maddox opened out his hands. The gesture made him look extremely vulnerable. I don't know, Geordi. I wish I did, but I don't. I can't understand it. Their programming didn't allow for it. LaForge looked back over his shoulder. The wall was transparent, and he could see that there were many people in the office beyond looking in at them, pretending not to, but looking nonetheless. He didn't blame them. He'd be doing the same thing. He drew in a steady breath. It was very important, he thought, that he did not lose his temper now. There was too much pain going around at the moment to cause more. He needed to be constructive. He needed to ask questions and find answers, and with that done, he would be able to let the dead rest in peace. But first, the questions. Bruce, he said, tell me straight. Did you take your eye off the ball? LaForge watched the man pale. What? Maddox whispered, and LaForge knew he'd been right. Bruce, did you cut corners? Bruce, you have to trust me. You have to tell me the truth. Were you working on something else? Maybe I was thinking about other things as well. A whole chasm of grief and horror opened between them. Oh, Bruce, man, what were you thinking? What the hell were you thinking? Geordi, you have to understand, my life's work. You kept on, didn't you? Like I told you not to. You kept on working on sentient synthetics. It's my dream, Geordi. It was that present tense that bugged him. Even now, even after all this, Maddox couldn't admit that he was done. LaForge gripped his head between his hands. People are looking, some calmer part of his mind said. Well, let them look. Everyone on Mars was pulled onto this, Bruce. Most of Starfleet was pulled onto this. Everyone sacrificed their projects, their goals. Sure, they hated it. Man, they hated it. Those people on Mars? All those dead people? Do you think they liked being asked to stop working on their projects? But they got on with it because they knew it had to be done. Oh, but not Dr. Bruce Maddox, the only genius among us? Is that what you told yourself? Your work? So special? So important? Yes, Maddox said, fiercely, dumbly. Yes, it is. Bruce! LaForge tried to calm himself down. I understand your passion. I do. I really do. Look around you. Look where it's led you. He watched as Maddox put his head in his hands. He did understand. He understood the loss, too. Softly, Geordi said, Data was unique, Bruce. You can't ever recreate him. Never going to happen. It's never going to happen. And look where it's ended. You think there's going to be work like this done ever again? It's over. All over. It's cost thousands upon thousands of lives. This is the end, Bruce. Verity, en route to Earth. Rafi Musiker lay in the darkness, listening to the soft, steady rhythms of the ship. After 30 hours on her feet, gathering information about what was happening back on Mars, JL had ordered her to go and get some rest. She'd returned to her cabin, eaten, and showered. She had thought about trying to speak to Jay and Gabe, but found that she couldn't face the conversation. Couldn't face the strain, the awkwardness, the unvoiced but ever-present reproach that had seeped into all their interactions. She could cope with the death throes of her family or the death throes of the mission to which she had sacrificed that family, but she couldn't cope with both. She lay in bed, eyes tired and burning, thoughts whirling restlessly like leaves stirred by sudden squalls. This attack, she thought, it could not be random. Nothing in the universe was random. There was a pattern to everything if you looked hard enough. There had to be. Otherwise the universe was meaningless, and Rafi couldn't bear that. She'd go insane if that was the case. Rafi clenched her fists together beside her in the darkness. She was not going to give up this mission, not without a fight. She had given everything. She got up and dressed. She looked at the half-empty bottle on the table. She was tempted for a moment, but she didn't want to risk having the smell on her breath. She left her cabin and went in search of her captain. As she'd predicted, he wasn't sleeping either. He was sitting alone in his cabin, contemplating, pondering.
No, thought Rafi, this is full-on brooding. Can we talk, Jael?
Of course, Rafi. She sat down on the couch opposite. She gave him a wan smile.
Hey, she said, I thought we'd ordered each other to get some rest.
I thought I might try asking your forgiveness later this morning.
You know what a soft touch I am.
Was there something in particular you wanted to talk to me about, Rafi?
She leaned forward in her seat, planted her hands firmly on her knees. Yes, Jael. Yes, there is.
Go on.
It's kind of wild.
I'm open to any ideas right now that might help me make sense of this catastrophe.
Okay, she said. Then try this. The more I think about this whole thing, Jael, the more I think it can't be an accident. I mean, Maddox is insisting, isn't he, that it can't be a flaw in the programming?
These are complex machines, Rafi.
But Maddox knows them.
That's true, he conceded.
So if it's not a flaw in the programming, then it has to be deliberate.
She saw his expression.
Listen, Jael, hear me out. These synths? Maddox says it couldn't happen this way. They're androids, toys, nothing more. It would be like...
She hunted around for a comparison.
Damn it, like your tricorder attacking you. It's not possible.
What else could it be, Rafi? Maddox has admitted to LaForge that he was preoccupied with other projects, that he was still working toward creating sentient life.
No, not that. Not the synths. I know this is going to sound crazy, JL, but I think there's something else going on.
Something else?
Something premeditated. Something planned.
Rafi, you have to understand, when you're dealing with artificial life in any form, you never know what to expect.
He's going to mention Data, she thought.
Data. At every turn, Data exceeded his programming. He became more and more alive.
A small glow suffused his face. Data, she thought. What was the special magic that lost creation had contained, which inspired such love, such devotion? What had been the power this machine had held to so enchant all those around him?
In many ways, said Picard, he was the most alive being I have ever encountered.
But these synths weren't Data, JL, she said.
No, he said. His face became sad. No, they were not. But everything I have seen, and Rafi, I have seen so much, so many marvelous, awe-inspiring, and yes, terrible things. After so many sights, I can well believe in the possibility that these synths came to consciousness.
Whether it was the lack of sleep, or the drink, or the sheer toll of the past 2 days, she was not making herself understood. JL, all I am saying is...
He reached out to her. He lifted one of her hands and pressed both of his around it.
She knew he was trying to console, but she had never felt so distanced from him. He was the wisest man she had ever known, and he had not understood what she was trying to tell him.
the most important thing she had ever had to say, and he had not understood.
Rafi, he said, it's natural to look for someone to blame. Many, many people are dead. But the fault is, who knows? Maybe Maddox overreached, didn't take enough care, made a mistake. Or maybe, just maybe, something sparked within these creations. Something emergent. Something we could not have calculated for. Maybe they woke and looked around and decided that they did not want to be our slaves.
J.L., please, listen.
We made them, Rafi. Perhaps we made them better than we intended. And when they woke, to consciousness, to sentience, they saw that their creators had made them only to make use of them, and they took the only action they could.
She stopped trying to explain. She was too tired, too heartsick. But she knew that she was not wrong. She might not have the proof yet, but damn it all, she would find that proof. She could not be wrong about this, because that way lay only chaos. He released her hand. She felt a powerful surge of love for him, but for the very first time it was tinged with disappointment.
Go to bed, Rafi, he said. We are heading for Earth. We need to sleep, and we need to be sharp, because there are many lives depending on us. Many people who as yet have not been brought to safety. Let us not lose sight of this. The next few days will be critical, and we need to be ready to do whatever we can to save this mission.
She left and went back to her cabin, but she did not go to bed, and she did not sleep for a long while. Instead, she poured some whiskey, and she started watching the casts, and those led her to the dark, virtual chambers where people trade in conspiracy and supposition. And she began what was to be a very rapid slide down, 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 down to somewhere a very long way from Wonderland. 15.
Admiral's Log. We are now within 6 hours of Earth and my meeting with Starfleet Command. The journey time here has been spent pulling apart our mission goals and trying to determine what will be needed in order for us to be able to continue our work. In this, as in so many things, Commander Musica has been invaluable, developing duty rosters, ship manifests, and all the necessary information for us to redeploy our resources. What is clear is that there is an interim short-term period where the mission will inevitably have to be reduced in scope, not only while we move ships from other tasks, but retool them for the purposes of ferrying our Romulan refugees to their new homes. While this is, obviously, a significant logistical task, I believe it is important for us to remember that all the preparation work to receive the refugees is comparatively unaffected by this Mars tragedy. A large proportion of the worlds to which we were carrying refugees have nearly completed the necessary infrastructure projects. Some will have to scale back. We are no longer so easily able to transport extra building material and other supplies to them, and refugees must take precedence, but these are activities that can be recommenced at a future date. The most important task is to ensure that the transportation of Romulans from the blast zone to safety continues uninterrupted. If we must resort for a while to small ships, Dunkirk comes to mind, we will still be able to save lives that would otherwise be lost. The alternative is unthinkable, and I cannot believe that anyone within Starfleet would countenance it. These people are blameless. They are guilty of no crime. The morning after the news broke, Tajuth came to see me, and for the first time, I glimpsed some warmth within the man. Perhaps it made a difference to him to be the one able to offer rather than to be the object of sympathy. At the same time, I could see that he was anxious to know what this would mean for the relief mission, but was not indelicate enough to ask outright. I have tried to assure him, to the best of my ability, that as far as I am concerned, this alters nothing. There is no evidence or even suggestion of Romulan culpability in the Mars tragedy, and therefore no reason why our mission should be diminished. It is of great importance, I believe, to keep our clarity about the relief mission. There are many desperate people in dire need of our help. I intend to suggest to Admiral Bordson that we now approach ambassadors from other powers to ask what further aid they might offer. Enmities between the Romulans and the Cardassian Union and the Klingon Empire go back many years, but each might well be reminded how the Federation came to them in their hour of need, and thus be persuaded to offer assistance. Rafi and I have not spoken again about our conversation the night after the attack, but I sense that our exchange then has put something at odds between us. I believe she has not set aside her suspicion that there is some deeper scheme, some hidden intent behind this catastrophe. I am aware that beyond the immediate tasks I have set her, she has been asking her former colleagues within Romulan affairs for a report on Tal Shiar activity as comprehensive as they can possibly muster. I imagine that this is temporary on Rafi's part. We all must process shock and grief in our own ways. For myself, I try when I can to speak to Zani. To know that something is still right is very important right now. Vashti remains my lodestone, the north on my compass. While Vashti flourishes, this mission has not failed. And this mission must not, cannot, will not fail.
Starfleet Command, San Francisco, Earth. Picard was sweating. For some reason, he had been expecting a cold day. In fact, it was bright, sunny. He pondered this miscalculation. Somewhere along the line, he had lost track of the seasons. He had fallen out of sync with Earth. The benches outside Starfleet HQ were hardly the best place for a briefing, or a pep talk, for that matter, but Rafi had insisted on coming down with him, and, given the opportunity, would probably have walked him to the door of Bordson's office, handing him newly updated duty rosters all the way there. "Rafi," he said at last, "everything will be fine."
"I want to be sure. Let's go through it one last time."
So, because he owed her so much, he went through everything one last time. "They'll start with the ships," he said. "But I can point them to the inventories from Beta Antares and Eridani A. So then they'll try staffing. But we have the duty rosters from personnel." She nodded throughout, even mouthed along with him at a few points, and when he came to the end, she grunted and looked satisfied.
"Good," she said. "Yeah, that's good."
She gave him an appraising look, and then reached out to fiddle with the Admiral's insignia on his collar like a mother fussing over her son's uniform on the first day of school.
"You'll do, I guess."
"Thank you, Lieutenant Commander Musica."
He watched her put her hands flat along her sides, trying to command her own nerves.
"Okay," she said. "This is a minor setback, isn't it?"
"Rafi, relax. We'll be back at work before we know it."
"Okay, well, we have a plan. And not just any old plan, it's a great plan."
He put his hand upon her shoulder.
"You've done good work, Rafi, under difficult and trying circumstances. I promise you that I will not let this mission be curtailed. We have to do what is right, even when we have been so grievously injured. Particularly when we have been so grievously injured."
She gave him a wry look, tempered with affection.
"Make a speech like that, and we can't go wrong. I'm glad you're the one fighting this battle, JL. Nobody's further up on the moral high ground than you."
"I think that was a compliment, Rafi."
"I meant it that way."
"Then I'll take it that way."
He checked the time. 10 minutes until his meeting. It took him 7.5 minutes, he knew, to get from this spot to the door of Bordson's office. There was no harm, however, in being timely.
"Right," he said. "Let's get this done. Let's get back to work."
"Good luck, JL."
He walked toward the entrance. Before he went inside, he glanced back over his shoulder and saw her sit down again on a bench. She already had a pad out, diving into some research or other. He smiled fondly and went inside. Inside, the mood within the building was taut as wire. People dashing about, no chatter. Action, any kind of action. He had seen this before, after stressful events. The need to keep busy, to do something. An ensign, waiting for him, hurried over and moved him briskly toward the elevator but did not meet his eye. He went into the commander-in-chief's office confident, sure of himself and his purpose, sure of his plans and of their overwhelming rightness. Bordson was there. Clancy. Two other Admiral's Hollows were projected over the long table. Morim from Trill and a Vulcan named Charu. Picard knew them, but he had not been expecting them. Their presence made no difference. He was sure of what he had to say.
"Admiral Picard," said Bordson, "thank you for coming. Please sit down."
Picard took the seat that Bordson offered. Clancy was sitting opposite. She looked exhausted. His heart went out to her. They had been sheltered on the Verity from having to deal with the immediate ramifications of the Mars tragedy.
"Kirsten," he said warmly.
She nodded rather brusquely.
"Jean-Luc."
Even her voice sounded ragged.
"Before we start, Jean-Luc," said Bordson, "I would like you to be clear that we have received all your reports and we have studied them in considerable detail."
Picard looked at him with a little surprise.
"I am sure that you have, Victor." "Good. So that you understand that we are not making any decisions lightly."
"Of course not." Picard frowned. What decisions could be made until he had shown them the revised evacuation plans?
"We should look at those reports in more detail. I have some further amendments to them that, as you will see, make the plan even more sustainable."
"The problem," said Admiral Morim, "lies in the fact that we have, in one fell swoop, lost our shipbuilding capabilities. The ships that do remain will have to perform double, triple duties."
"Yes, naturally I understand this concern," said Picard. "Let me draw your attention to these most recent inventories from Beta Antares and Eridani A. There are a number of retired ships that, with some work, can be retooled."
"Who will do this work exactly?" Charu asked. "There is also a question of labor."
"Duty reserve officers," said Picard promptly.
This was going exactly how Raffi had predicted.
"We have been speaking—"
"The mission," said Morim, "depended on synthetic labor."
There was a pause. Picard, noting that past tense, began to perceive that something was not right.
"I understand that there are significant concerns about synthetic labor."
He heard Clancy opposite breathe out.
"Exasperation?"
"Let us turn," said Bordson, "to the matter of the synths. You need to know, Jean-Luc, that there is, with immediate effect, a ban on the production of synthetics within the Federation. Furthermore, there is a ban on research that might lead in any way to the creation of any form of synthetic life."
"That is a very stringent ruling, Victor."
"In the face of thousands dead," noted Charu. "It is also a direct order from the Council," said Bordson. "The synth production facility at the Daystrom Institute is, as we speak, being shut down, and once the forensic inquiry is finished, it will be completely decommissioned. There is no question of further use of synths within the Federation."
"Of course," Picard said cautiously.
He and Raffi had discussed something along these lines, not so draconian as a complete ban on research, but certainly cutting back on synths for the immediate future.
"Naturally, this leaves us with some questions about how we can meet our objectives in terms of ship construction. But I am sure that—"
"Admiral Picard," said Clancy, "the shipyards on Mars have been obliterated. The Martian stratosphere is on fire. There is no ship construction."
The switch to his title set the alarm bells thoroughly ringing. Quietly, but persistently.
"I understand, Captain. But there are other options."
"None of which can meet the scale that this operation requires."
"And we will have to," Picard said gently but firmly. "The Romulans manifestly do not have the capacity to remove the people remaining within blast range. I will not be surprised if we are called on soon to assist in evacuating the homeworld itself."
Bordson raised an admonitory hand.
Please, he said. Jean-Luc, I am afraid that you have not been privy to the kinds of conversations that Command has been conducting over the past few weeks. The appetite for this mission was already waning.
That's an understatement, muttered Clancy.
The will has gone, Bordson stated. Now the alarm bells were something more of a red alert.
Victor, you can't—
I appreciate the time that you and Lieutenant Commander Musica have put into these plans, Jean-Luc, but they are unfeasible. The relief mission is over. For a split second, Picard thought that he had misheard. But no. Bordson was looking back at him calmly and compassionately. Clancy was looking at him implacably. The others, they were not meeting his eyes. Suddenly, he sensed the fear in the room, even from the Vulcan admiral. But this fear? This was not how a decision of this magnitude should be made.
I'm afraid, said Picard. That is not acceptable.
Clancy pushed back in her chair. The alternative, sir, she said, is the breakup of the Federation. You've been gone a long time. I've spent every day, day after day, trying to keep the Council on our side. We've come close to having worlds secede over this. The entire Federation is starting to ask again what exactly this mission has brought us, and they look at Mars and see nothing but grief.
That is not the fault of anyone in Romulan space, Captain, said Picard. You know that as well as I do. It is imperative that we distinguish between the tragedy that has happened on Mars and what continues to be happening on a daily basis within Romulan space.
Sure, yes, I know the difference. And yet I still have 14 member worlds telling me that they will start the process of seceding from the Federation if this mission continues, Clancy shot back. We needed a win, and instead we got... She threw her hands up. We got hell.
Picard turned to Bordson.
Sir,
he said, softly, urgently, sensing that the other man was not entirely sympathetic to this course of action.
This is a grotesque decision. This is a renunciation of the Federation's core values in the most unforgivable way. There are still many, many people in desperate need.
He looked bitterly at Clancy.
You say that I don't understand, Kirsten. I've seen the refugee camps, the desperation, the sheer need.
Bordson cut in.
I'm sorry, Jean-Luc, he said. This is the decision of the Council agreed by the President. The mission is over. I have spoken already to Ambassador Sulda. We have agreed a number of replicators and archiprinters will remain for a period of time on the worlds to which they have already been assigned. But the ships must come home.
Dead silence.
Jean-Luc? I will not do that, said Picard.
That is an order, said Bordson. You must instruct the fleet home. A number of them will be tasked with the Mars cleanup.
No, said Picard. Starfleet may accept my revised evacuation plan, or it accepts my resignation.
For God's sake, Admiral, it's a direct order, burst out Clancy. The mission is over.
Admiral Picard, said Bordson again, mildly, if you can't accept these orders, then I will accept your resignation.
Later, sitting in splendid isolation in his manor, Monsieur Picard would often wonder whether what he did had been meant as a threat or a gamble, or whether he had known when he said it that the game was over. Whatever the case, it was his last throw of the dice, his last chance to salvage something from this terrible situation, his last, best chance to save lives.
Then I resign from Starfleet with immediate effect.
If he had been expecting some protest, it did not come. He rose to his feet.
It seems we are finished here.
It seems we are, said Bordson. Jean-Luc, for what it's worth, I am very sorry.
Don't, said Picard. I don't want to hear it.
He turned, walked away from them, and left the room. He left the fleet and the mission, and, yes, he left Starfleet behind him. He was striding across the atrium before the enormity of this decision hit home. It hit him physically, a tremendous and sudden shock that left him trembling. He had no idea how the events of the last half hour had happened. He had no grasp of the paths, the decisions, the steps that had brought him to this pass. Picard had not, for many years now, experienced so profoundly, so devastatingly, what it was to fail, and to fail so completely.
Where do I go now? What shall I do?
He walked out into the square. Rafi was still sitting where he had left her.
What do I say to her?
His hand went up to his face, reached to touch his deepest and most abiding scar.
What good am I? What am I for? Who am I now?
Daystrom Institute, Okinawa, Earth. Bruce Maddox stood outside the meeting room and for a moment thought he could not do what he'd come here to do.
All I wanted, he thought, was to be left to do work.
That was the bitterest pill to swallow in the end. They had come to him, demanded that he turn his mind toward this project, and now here he was, the man who had created the monster.
Not my fault,
a part of him screamed, while another part taunted,
Are you sure of that, Bruce?
But one thing was true. It was certainly not the fault of the people waiting for him beyond these doors. They had done everything that had been asked of them and more, and he had a duty to them, to tell them why their world was coming to an end. He swallowed, took a deep breath, and pushed open the door and went inside. His team looked up at him, some fearful, some hopeful, and some, well, they knew where the cards were falling. Over in the far corner sat Agnes Girotti. She met his eyes briefly and gave the saddest of smiles and stuck both thumbs up.
Oh, Aggie, he thought, why are you so good to me?
He stood at the front and folded his arms.
Thanks for coming, he said. I know this isn't easy. The first thing I want to say is, I couldn't have asked for a better team. All of you, you're outstanding. You won't struggle to find posts after this, I promise you. Coas has given me her word.
He gave a faint laugh.
You know, not everyone gets to have their name attached to a catastrophe like this. But it's my name that's attached, not yours. I want you to know that. Your scientific careers won't suffer because of...
me, he thought.
This, he said.
Bruce, said someone from the back. He carried on quickly.
The program's over immediately, he said.
He heard a soft cry go up from someone. Not all.
I'm sorry, this is the only outcome. The synths are banned.
But everything we didn't do anything wrong, someone said.
I know that. None of you did anything wrong. But we can't appeal to reason right now. We can't appeal to science. People are scared. They look at the A-500s and they see killing machines. They see mass murderers.
They weren't like that!
Already their work was in the past tense, even from those protesting.
I know, he said, but that's the way it is. Everything is being turned off. Everything is being dismantled. Everything is being destroyed. You're welcome to stay here at the robotics division, but if you do, you have to understand that your lines of research are about to become severely limited. You'll be able to work on abstract design, but you will never be able to build another synthetic.
Bruce, that's absurd. They can't shut down a complete line of scientific inquiry. That's Dark Ages stuff, man.
They can, he said, and they have. You try building something now and you're going to find yourself in jail. My advice? Leave the Institute. At the very least, particularly for those of you still working on doctorates, find another line of research as quickly as you can.
I know this might mean throwing away 2 or 3 years of work, and it's damn unfair, but that's the way it is. You are not to blame for this, and you will not be held accountable. But you need to put your time here behind you and move on as quickly as you can."
He opened the floor to questions and answered them as calmly and as rationally as he could. As he expected, most of the people in the room were now anxious about what they should do next. He did his best to suggest people to speak to, topics to pursue, anything to get them going on another path of research and put this whole house of horrors behind them. At last, they were mostly satisfied and started to filter out of the room. Eventually, there was only one other person left. Agnes Girotti closed the door behind her colleagues.
"Bruce," she said.
She looked pale, shocked.
"This can't be over. This can't be the end."
"It is, Aggie. It's finished."
"What are we going to do?"
"You heard my advice. Get out. Find some other work. I know you're further on than others, Aggie. I know it will be harder."
"I'm not leaving here. I'm not leaving you."
He could not quite meet her eye.
"Bruce, what's going on?"
"I won't be here, Aggie. I'm finished here. I'm quitting right now. I'm gone."
She looked at him in dismay.
"Bruce, you can't go."
"I have to. I can't stay here. If I can't work."
He reached out one hand, although he didn't quite dare touch her.
"You could come with me, Aggie."
"Where would we go?"
"I don't know. Somewhere? A place where we can carry on this work? Our beautiful, important work?"
Suddenly, he saw how it could be, the two of them together, side by side, the necessary pair that would make this breakthrough.
"Bruce," she said, "I can't go. I'm too..."
Castles in the air, collapsing all around him. No, of course she wouldn't go with him. Why would she?
"All right. I understand."
"Bruce, I'm sorry."
"It's all right. Forget I ever asked. Goodbye, Aggie."
He turned his back on her and left. He could hear her calling his name, but he didn't answer.
"I'm gone," he thought,
and while he did not know where he was going, he did not think, "Who am I now?" or "What shall I do?" Bruce Maddox had never really doubted himself or his great elusive dream. He never did. Some say that history is the deeds of great men. Others say that history is women following behind with a bucket. After the great men weary of performing great deeds, after they lay down their tools and retire from their quests, what happens next? Life goes on, at least until it ends. Some people were barely affected. Dr. Amal Safadi, for example, who had done good work, done her best, no less, and showed courage in the face of adversity, and had not backed down, and had given people the information they needed to save millions of lives, she was largely unaffected. She was shocked, of course, as anyone else within the Federation would be, first by the news of the attack on Mars, and then again at the abrupt ending of the Romulan relief mission. She, like many others at Cambridge, was deeply concerned by this. She, unlike many others in her circle, went to the trouble of contacting her representatives and registering her disappointment and distress that the Romulan people were being abandoned. She never received a wholly satisfactory answer, and she began to realize that her view was in the minority. Even some of her more enlightened acquaintances were heard to say, "Perhaps we'd done enough. Perhaps we need to look after our own people." What upset her the most, she realized as the months went past, was that she could find no trace of Nokem Vritet. She still did not believe he had written the condemnation of her report that had led to her being called before a Federation committee. She knew he was too meticulous, too good a scientist. She worried about what had happened to him in those last terrifying days. For many years after, Safadi held out hope that she might find him, tucked away in a refugee camp somewhere.
She would bring him back to Cambridge, find him a quiet office, and they would work together. For many years, she held out this hope, long beyond anything rational. Long after he had died. Olivia Quest had played her cards carefully, and if anyone remembered her enthusiasm for the synthetics, she was, by some sorcery, able to persuade them to forget. Her vocal support for the synth ban helped, as did the many speeches she made after the Romulan mission was ended. She busied herself outlining her vision of a new deal for smaller member worlds such as her own. Closer involvement in decision-making, more access to resources. These were trying times on the border, since the collapse of the Romulan Star Empire and the Federation needed to look after its own. Quest faced no difficulty in being re-elected to the Council, and in time became the senior representative for Estolon. She did not hesitate to take on other jobs as well. The Federation Security Council was her ultimate aim, and who would doubt that she would succeed? Admiral Bordson remained in his post for a few more years, but it was clear to those who knew him that his heart was no longer in it. There was some relief when Kirsten Clancy rose to the rank of admiral and then to CNC. A number of officers found themselves reassigned in the weeks that followed the end of the mission. For some of them, this was a wrench. For others, less so. They were used to being sent where they were needed and turning themselves immediately to the task at hand. That was what Starfleet was all about for them. A few, not enough, remained in post on the small border worlds that had found themselves the new homes of thousands of desperate and sometimes hostile people. All along the old neutral zone, in fragile systems that stretched for light years from the Kyrus sector to the Imian sector, they found themselves trying to hold the thin line between structure and chaos. Some quit quietly. Why should they stay? They had been told in no uncertain terms that their work had no value. They left, and the buildings, half done, crumbled, and with them the trust and the hope evaporated. A vacuum into which less selfless and more grasping powers moved. Then there were the worlds left behind, the worlds that had been waiting for salvation. Refugees huddled into transit camps, looking up at skies for ships that were no longer coming. Shall we think about what must have happened to them? These lives that, as it turned out, counted for so little in the great scheme of things. Can we bear to imagine what came next? The slow death of hope and the sudden birth of despair, and at last, the violent, screaming end. These were the true victims. But there were others. Geordi LaForge, perhaps, thinking of his lucky escape, thinking of the ones he had left behind. Sometimes it would catch up with him unawares. A simple thing might set him off, looking for a book or a tool, realizing that it had been in his quarters on Mars. He spent days thinking about how close that shave had been. There was Zani, who knew that promises should not be made and was therefore perhaps best equipped to cope when they were not kept. But there was also Elnor. How did one explain these things to a child? There was the crew of the Verity that had set out so bravely, who found themselves leaderless and torn from a mission to which they had given their all. And let us not forget Rafi Musiker, left suddenly without job or purpose, sidelined by her association with the man who walked away. Rafi, who had sacrificed a marriage, had sacrificed motherhood to this task. Rafi, who could not make herself believe that the universe would be this cruel, this capricious, and went in search of some kind of explanation, no matter how outlandish, no matter how unlikely. Anything, God, please, anything that would make sense of it all. History had been made, yes, somehow, but history has its own agenda. And for those expelled from the courts and councils of the great, history can be very cruel. Epilogue. Labar, France.
How do you find a home when home is gone? How do you settle in a place when you wish to be elsewhere? Jean-Luc Picard dumped his bags in the hall and looked around what others might call the family home and felt dread fall upon him like a heavy cloak.
I am useless, he thought. I am without purpose.
The day passed, so did the next, and the one after. The sun rose and went overhead and then set, as was its wont. Sometimes he noticed that the sunset was beautiful. Sometimes he did not. He was not entirely isolated. Messages came. There was one from Zani, asking him to remember them. He pushed it aside and was ashamed as he did so, knowing how inexcusably he was breaking a promise.
I have been prevented from keeping it, he thought bitterly.
His mind would go back to that last conversation with Starfleet Command, and how little it meant to them in the end. A message came from Will and Deanna. You did the right thing. Some consolation, he thought, but not much. What does one do with empty hours? What does one do with enforced freedom? Picard took long walks. He beat the bounds of his estate, started to learn each centimeter of it in the manner of his forebears. But even as he came to know each field, each blade of grass, each vine, he resented his presence here. As a boy, he had kept his eyes from the land, looking upward at the sky, at the stars, and had promised himself that he would go there. He had kept that promise. Once, he had held whole star systems in the hollow of his hand. And yet, in the end, he had overreached and had fallen ignominiously back to Earth like burned Icarus. The stars were lost to him now. He had lost everything that he loved. He was exiled, and he could see no way back. The days are long and quiet. They accumulate. There is no end to them. Picard walks the lanes around his fields. He broods. He writes long, long books about great men and great deeds. Wine is made and drunk. Winter comes, then spring, then harvest, then another deep, cold winter. The cycle is endless. The huge clock ticks in the hall, eating time. His mind goes around in circles.
What shall I do now? Where do I go? Who am I?
Beyond the window, he hears Laris and Jaban muttering about him. Beside him, the dog, a kind gift from kind friends, catches his mood and whines. Picard reaches down, strokes the soft fur behind its ears. The dog, consoled, looks back up with love. Picard smiles despite all. He stands and walks to the door. The little creature trots loyally beside him.
Come, number one. We can't sit here forever. Let's find something to do.
Star Trek Picard, The Last Best Hope, was written by Una McCormick and read by Robert Petkoff. It was recorded by James Yost at Reservoir Studios. Editing by Christina Picciano and Ethan Donaldson. Post-production by Karen Perlman. The associate producers were Anna Chan and Claire Tatakoro. Star Trek Picard, The Last Best Hope, was produced and directed by Karen Perlman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Star Trek Picard, The Last Best Hope, is available in print from Gallery Books. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Star Trek, the original series, The Higher Frontier, written by Christopher L. Bennett and read by Robert Petkoff.